Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
7 years ago, I was filming at East London Mosque when the story broke. The three schoolgirls from the area had gone missing. They were heading to Syria to join the Islamic State group. Shamima Begum was the only one of the girls to emerge from the ashes of the so-called caliphate. I've retraced her steps to investigate the truth of her story.
What do you think people think of you?
As a danger, as a risk.
The Shamima Begum Story, Series 2 of I'm Not a Monster.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 15th of January, these are our main stories. Russia has launched another major missile attack on Ukraine, killing at least five people in an apartment block in Dnipro and leaving many regions without power. Tens of thousands of protesters have rallied in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv, condemning proposed changes to the legal system as an attack on democratic rule. The White House says more classified documents have been found at President Biden's family home. Also in this podcast,
it was all Joe's decision, and it was disastrous for Rosemary. Back then, family members were told by doctors to hide the mentally ill person.
Rosemary Kennedy, sister of the former US President JFK, spent many years in an institution. Now an opera about her hidden life is opening in London. A nine-story apartment building ripped apart. Smoke rising out of the gaping hole as cars lie crushed in front of it. That was the scene of one of Russia's latest attacks on Ukraine in the city of Dnipro. At least five people were killed. Dozens more were injured, including children. After a fortnight without major airstrikes, Russia once again on Saturday hit cities across Ukraine, from Kharkiv in the east to Lviv in the west, to Odessa on the southern coast. Our correspondent, James Waterhouse, spoke to us from a shelter in the Ukrainian capital.
Sirens go off now and then, but on a day like today, we were told in no uncertain terms not to ignore them. Concerningly, the sirens didn't sound for a couple of hours after the first explosions. Reason being, we're told, is that ballistic missiles were launched by Russian forces, which are more difficult to detect because of the altitude and speed that they fly at. So we're told that infrastructure has been hit on the left bank of the Dnipro River in the east of the city. We're also told residential blocks have been damaged. Kyiv is sadly well rehearsed in preparing for large-scale missile and drone attacks. It's been a relatively quiet fortnight. The last time this happened was on New Year's Day, but it's a depressing routine.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. After these strikes, much of Ukraine was under an emergency blackout. Julian Marshall spoke to Yuri Sak, advisor to Ukraine's defence minister, and asked him about the Russian missile attacks.
Over 30 missiles were launched at Ukrainian cities. The Ukrainian Air Defense Forces, according to our general staff, have been able to intercept 21 of them preliminary. Now, the most damage was done to the city of Dnipro, where blocks of residential flats was targeted by a missile. And as a result, for now, five people are confirmed dead, over 60 are wounded, and among them about 17 children, and the emergency works, the rescue works continue. There is a very high likelihood that there are still people under the rubble, and the emergency works will continue throughout the night to make sure that everybody who is still in need of help will receive that help. This is just another proof that Russia is a terrorist state, and it should be expelled from the international community, from the UN, from everywhere, because it is absolutely a disgrace that a country which is committing atrocities of this magnitude is still has a seat on reputable international organizations.
Have Russian missile attacks in the past been this widespread, hitting the west, the north, the south, and the center of the country?
Yes, this is the 12th massive missile strike, and in the past we've already had situations where different parts, different regions of Ukraine, across Ukraine, would have been targeted. And today, as a result of this strike, of course, more damage has been done to Ukraine's power grids, to Ukraine's electricity infrastructure. Some regions are now without electricity. Emergency power cuts and power outages are in place. So, you know, this is not new, but this is actually why Ukraine continues to say that priority number one for us is modern air defense systems, because without them, you know, our cities will be at risk. It will continue to terrorize our cities.
I mean, we're constantly being told that Russia is running low on missiles, and yet it was able to fire, what, some 30 today? And as far as I understand, no drones were involved.
Yeah, well, exactly. Russia, on the one hand, we know for a fact that they are running out of these missiles. And if you compare the amount of missiles that they've been launching before to even today's strike, that number reduced. Because before, in the past, we've had missile strikes where even 100 missiles would be launched on the same day. At the same time, we also know that Russia continues to produce their own missiles. Our defense intelligence a couple of weeks back said that they still have stockpiles of missiles which would be enough for at least 2-3 massive strikes. And one of them happened today.
Yuri Sak, advisor to Ukraine's defense minister. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has welcomed confirmation by Britain that it will provide tanks to Ukraine. He said the decision would strengthen Ukraine's forces on the battlefield.
This is really what's needed, and I believe that similar decisions will be made by our other partners, those who understand why the evil of Russia's invasion cannot be given a single chance, because such evil knows no boundaries.
It's thought that about a dozen Challenger tanks will be provided. In response, the Russian embassy in London said this move by Britain would only intensify combat operations and generate more casualties. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
The UK is the first Western nation to confirm it'll provide Ukraine with modern main battle tanks. It'll be the British Army's Challenger 2, a tank more than 20 years old, but designed and built to go up against Russian armour. But it won't be many, around a dozen. Ukraine says it needs another 300 tanks. Its hope is that other nations will follow. Germany's Leopard tank is operated by several European armies. Poland says it wants to send some, but that still needs Germany's approval. The US, Ukraine's biggest military backer, is also being asked to provide some of its Abrams tanks. General Sir Richard Barons, a former senior British commander, believes the UK's decision does signal a shift.
It's not a game changer in terms of numbers, but it is a game changer in terms of demonstrating the will to send a higher order of military equipment to help Ukraine fend off the coming Russian offensive and go on the offensive themselves with much better combat power.
So far in Ukraine, tanks on their own have proved to be relatively easy targets. Ukraine claims to have destroyed or damaged more than 1,000. But Western military experts say that tanks combined with infantry, artillery and air support will be essential to take back territory. The West is slowly but surely stepping up its support from defence to offence.
Jonathan Beale. Tens of thousands of protesters have rallied in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv for the second consecutive Saturday, describing proposed changes to the judiciary as an attack on democratic rule. Rallies were also held in Jerusalem and Haifa. Here's our Middle East analyst, Mike Thompson.
Protesters brandishing banners saying government of shame and bring down the dictator have taken to the streets of Tel Aviv. The latter demand in reference to the country's new prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose coalition government took power last month. Many claim its planned judicial overhaul would amount to the death of democracy in Israel. Among those who vowed to attend the rally is the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. He's accused Mr. Netanyahu's government of planning what amounts to a coup.
Mike Thompson. The execution of a British-Iranian national in Tehran has sparked international outrage, further escalating tensions between Iran and the West. Ali Reza Akbari, a former Iranian deputy defence minister, had been convicted of spying for the UK. But as evidence emerged that he'd been tortured and forced into confessing, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak accused Iran of a cowardly act. The UK has sanctioned Iran's Prosecutor General for his role in Mr. Akbari's death and has temporarily recalled Britain's representative in Tehran. France, Germany and the US also condemned the execution as barbaric. Here's our diplomatic correspondent Caroline Hawley.
News of the execution came on state-run television despite repeated last-minute appeals from the UK. Ali Reza Akbari became a British citizen after investing in Britain and had lived here for several years. His family say he'd been enticed back to Iran by his former boss, under whom he once served as Deputy Defence Minister. He was arrested back in 2019, but until a few days ago, neither his family nor the Iranian authorities had made the case public. Earlier this week came news he'd been sentenced to death for spying, with relatives told to pay him a final visit. In an audio recording obtained by BBC Persian, he said he'd been forced to confess after being subjected to 3,500 hours of interrogations and torture. He said he'd been charged with obtaining top-secret intelligence in exchange for a bottle of perfume and a shirt, and he accused Iran of wanting to take revenge on the UK by killing him. The Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, announced the UK's response.
The UK government made it clear that we would respond. And therefore, in response to this execution, we have summoned the Iranian chargé d'affaires, we have imposed sanctions against the Prosecutor General, and we have also decided to temporarily withdraw our ambassador for further consultations.
The UK is currently preparing to declare Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guards a terrorist organisation in response to Tehran's brutal crackdown against protests. Mr. Akbari's nephew, Ramin Forghani, told me he thought that could account for the timing of his uncle's execution. He also sees it as part of an internal power struggle within a desperate regime.
It's been a horrific few days. The character that I knew, the person that was devoted to the country, the regime itself, the person that was involved with the system from the very beginning of its foundation, would not contemplate to do anything that would jeopardize or harm either the regime nor the population.
Whatever the exact motive for Ali Reza Akbari's execution, it sends a chilling message and marks a dramatic new low in relations between Britain and Iran.
Caroline Hawley. To the delight of Republicans and the embarrassment of Democrats, the White House has reported that another batch of classified papers has been found at President Biden's Delaware home. This is an addition to documents already found at the House and at a former office in Washington. A special counsel has been appointed to investigate. Our Washington correspondent, David Willis, told us what was known about this latest find.
For Republicans, this is very much the gift that keeps on giving for President Biden and the Democrats. It's further embarrassing revelations. And the White House, of course, has been heavily criticized over the past few days for what was seen as its somewhat begrudging admission of the existence of these documents and the fact that the initial discovery was made more than 2 months ago, the day before the midterm elections, in fact, back in November of last year. Well, it's now seeking to, I think, get out in front of this situation by admitting today to the discovery of five more classified documents at Joe Biden's home in Wilmington, Delaware, after one classified document was found in the garage there. That makes six in all from that location, in addition to between 10 and a dozen from an office that Mr. Biden used whilst he was serving as a vice president under Barack Obama.
And what does this mean for Mr. Biden? Because on the one hand, he faces the potential of criminal charges, but there's also the matter of the fact that he wanted to announce his bid to run for re-election.
Well, that's right. And President Biden's lawyers are attempting to draw a pretty firm distinction, I think, between the discovery of these classified documents and those involving Donald Trump. The White House is stressing that it returned the documents found in Joe Biden's house and office, as it put it, quickly and voluntarily. Unlike Mr. Trump, who allegedly obstructed government attempts to retrieve hundreds of classified documents to the point where it took an FBI raid to get them from him. Nonetheless, as I mentioned, the first cache of Biden documents was discovered as far back as November, just before the midterm elections, yet only acknowledged on Monday. And that's prompted accusations by Republicans that it was kept secret, possibly for political reasons.
David Willis. When people hear the name Kennedy, they tend to think of the political dynasty, President John F. Kennedy, or his two brothers, Robert and Ted. But there were other siblings, including Rosemary, who lived most of her life in the shadows. She suffered brain damage at birth, but it was the lobotomy that she underwent at the age of 23, a controversial form of brain surgery that left her severely disabled. For decades, she was locked away in an institution with no contact with her family. Now an opera is opening in London that looks at Rosemary Kennedy's life. Vincent Dowd reports.
In London in 1938, Rosemary Kennedy, aged 20, was presented as a debutante to the British royal family.
And this year that thrill was experienced by Miss Rosemary and Miss Kathleen Kennedy, daughters of the American ambassador.
The Kennedy family's time in Britain seems to have been a relatively happy interlude for Rosemary. Liz Pentecoff wrote a book about her called The Missing Kennedy. She says Rosemary, one of nine children of Joseph and Rose Kennedy, had been recognised early on as developmentally challenged.
Rosemary was probably about 7 and a half by now. So the Kennedys took Rosie to Harvard, where doctors examined her. Had modern medicine known about her, they would have said she was learning disabled.
I don't want to see this country go to war unless we're attacked, but we must get strong, and that quickly.
Joseph Kennedy had failed hopes of winning the White House, and later he worked to ensure his oldest surviving son, John, became president. With the family back from London, Rosemary was becoming more erratic. So was the decision in 1941 to have brain surgery for her and send her off to a distant institution a political convenience?
It was all Joe's decision. And it was disastrous for Rosemary.
Do you think there's any sense of wanting to get an embarrassing member of the family out of the way?
Back then, family members were told by doctors to hide the mentally ill person away and never let them come out.
For 64 years, Rosemary remained unseen by the public. It was only in the 60s, when Joe Kennedy was frail and dying, that her famous family started to see her regularly. The opera tries to communicate Rosemary's sense of dislocation. As a child, Liz Pentecoff came to know Rosemary well through her aunt, a nun, who was a carer for her.
When Mrs. Kennedy came to visit her, my aunt and two other nuns went to the airport with Rosie, and Mrs. Kennedy opened her arms as if to embrace her daughter when suddenly Rosie just started hitting her mother with her fists and screaming a primal scream as if to say, "Where have you been these past 20 years?"
Now, That report by Vincent Dowd. Still to come.
It's All the Way with Uncle Ray. Music of the 60s and 70s. Starting off as usual with the King, Elvis Presley.
The world's longest working DJ, whose career spanned six decades, Ray Cordero, has died at the age of 98. The World Health Organization has urged China to continue to provide detailed information about a wave of COVID infections, which is now known to have killed nearly 60,000 people in just over a month. A WHO statement said the data would allow for a better understanding of the impact of the disease. After weeks of only reporting a few fatalities a day, if that, on Saturday, China admitted that the surge in deaths had been much higher since it abruptly dropped its strict COVID rules in the wake of widespread protests. But an official from China's National Health Commission, Zhao Yaohui, insisted the worst was over and cases were now falling sharply.
The number of fever clinic visits peaked on December the 23rd at 2.8 million. On January the 11th, the number went down to 520,000, a reduction of more than 80%. Now the fever clinics are seeing a decline of patient visits, and in villages we're seeing the same trend.
I asked our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, why China had suddenly decided to admit to a far higher number of deaths than it had before.
The Chinese government doesn't explain itself. It doesn't say why it's given figures usually. I mean, it did say why it wasn't giving figures because it was too difficult to count them, but it hasn't really explained why it suddenly changed its mind. These statistics, 60,000 deaths, as you mentioned there, were just slipped into a press conference earlier on Saturday, and then the person, the health official who gave them, just moved swiftly on. But yes, they are really, really remarkable because for the last month or so, one or two deaths a day, those numbers seem to be completely out of kilter with what we were seeing on the ground in China, hospitals inundated, people queuing up for crematoriums, that kind of thing. So we knew the figures were bigger. Now we know how big they were. Although these are only deaths from hospitals, there could have been people who died elsewhere, in old people's homes, at home, that kind of thing. So the true number could be even higher than 60,000.
As you say, these figures only include deaths in hospitals. Can we trust these figures?
It's difficult to say because, of course, last week we're getting one set of figures, now we've got some others. So are there other figures that we haven't heard of? That's always a question you've got to ask yourself with China, because there's little independent way in which we can verify any kind of numbers. In more open societies, you have a range of organisations which are able to access raw data and check the figures which governments are giving out. In China, you just don't have that ability. So you just have to accept, to a certain extent, the figures that you get from the government with the proviso that you're not certain, you can't check yourself whether they're accurate or not.
And the Chinese authorities are now saying that cases have gone past the peak. But is that true, given the fact that the Chinese are preparing to mark Lunar New Year, when hundreds of millions of people will travel across the country to visit their families?
I mean, that's a great point. And that's one thing that many people involved with COVID are worried about. All these people, hundreds of millions, travelling all across the country, potentially spreading the virus even further to every corner, every village of China. And some scientists, some experts are warning that the focus now should be on rural areas, where it has to be said in China the medical facilities aren't nearly as good as they are in the cities. So that's a consideration. There are people who are saying, suggesting that perhaps the peak of the wave hasn't ended, that it will last for a couple more months. And the experiences that other countries have had, remember, China only opened up at the beginning of December. It seems awfully quick to say that the wave has already peaked. We know in other countries it's taken a lot of time for people to become infected, a lot longer time for people to start dying and continue dying. So I think it's perhaps a little early, a little premature to say that we've hit the top of this wave.
Michael Bristow, in the first round of presidential elections in the Czech Republic, a retired NATO general, Petr Pavel, has narrowly beaten the billionaire former Prime Minister Andrej Babiš. The two men will face each other in a runoff vote in 2 weeks. I spoke to the BBC's Rob Cameron, who's in Prague, and asked him about the two presidential candidates. Very different individuals.
Petr Pavel, he's a silver-bearded military man. He was pretty much unknown until fairly recently, and he's now, you know, the front runner to become the new president of the Czech Republic with Andrej Babiš, this controversial billionaire businessman who's only just this Monday been acquitted of EU subsidy fraud by a court in Prague, who is challenging him for that post. So these two men go head to head in 2 weeks' time for this second round runoff to succeed the current president, Miloš Zeman, who steps down after 10 years in the post in March.
And the outgoing president is quite a controversial figure as well. How important is this post of president?
Well, successive presidents in this country, in the Czech Republic and indeed in Czechoslovakia, since its foundation in 1918, have really carved out a rather outsized role for the post of president, which is supposed to be a ceremonial position, head of state, because this is, after all, a parliamentary democracy. But the men who filled that role in the last 20 years, so that's Miloš Zeman and before him Václav Klaus, Eurosceptic president, they've really pushed at the boundaries of the role of president, you know, delaying legislation and, in Mr. Zeman's case, kind of running a kind of parallel foreign policy by meeting, you know, Vladimir Putin and the Chinese leader when the government wasn't so keen on that. So it's much more than just a symbol of this country. It's someone who really has clear influence on Czech politics and Czech government. But these two contenders, at least Mr. Pavel, say it's time to have very much a sort of regular head of state, a person who's going to respect the rules and not break them.
Rob Cameron. Dementia is a growing health threat all over the world, and now new research carried out by British scientists suggests that hormone replacement therapy may help to prevent Alzheimer's for millions of women at risk of developing the condition. The study looked into the effect HRT had on memory and cognitive function in women with a gene linked to Alzheimer's. But further research will be needed to prove a definite link. Simon Jones has the details of these early findings.
HRT is taken to help control symptoms of the menopause, but researchers at the University of East Anglia believe the therapy could also have another benefit. They examined the results of cognitive tests and data recorded by MRI scans and concluded the use of HRT is associated with better memory and larger brain volumes among women carrying the APOE4 gene. About a quarter of women in the UK are thought to have the gene, which is considered a risk factor for developing Alzheimer's. Professor Anne-Marie Minahane, who led the study, says while they don't want to give false hope at this early stage, this is still an important breakthrough.
The effects of HRT was equivalent to being several years younger. And the other major news, I suppose, was that the earlier the better, that HRT use seemed to be particularly beneficial in women who started it during the perimenopausal or early postmenopausal period.
The team examined data from almost 2,000 women from 10 countries. But this was an observational study rather than a clinical trial, and it didn't look at dementia cases, but cognitive performance. The researchers admit it's too early to say for sure that HRT reduces the dementia risk in women, and charities say more studies are needed on a larger scale to better understand any potential link.
Simon Jones. It's been a turbulent day for the supporters and directors of the Premier League football club Everton as it languishes at the bottom of the league. The board of directors missed Saturday's game against Southampton because of what the club called a real and credible threat to their safety and security. Everton's 2-1 loss to Southampton was the latest in a string of defeats for the team, which has triggered protests criticising its management. Patrick Geary watched the match at Goodison Park.
Even before the damaging defeat against Southampton, which left them in the bottom three of the Premier League, Everton had called this a profoundly sad day. In a statement, they said security advisers had told members of the board not to go to today's game after they'd received malicious and unacceptably threatening correspondence. They stated that individuals on the board had been the subject of physically threatening behaviour at recent matches. Everton find themselves in a second successive fight against relegation from the Premier League, and the mood around them has been darkening for some time, with fans protesting at how the club is run. A group of supporters called NS Now staged a sit-in after full-time at Goodison Park, demanding that owner Farhad Moshiri make what they call sweeping leadership changes. Greg O'Keefe covers Everton for The Athletic.
It just underlines how difficult this period's been, how angry some supporters are, and I like to think that the vast majority of fans would never do anything to genuinely, you know, threaten board members. This is a family club, but the fact that there's a feeling that someone could do something that could threaten their safety is really shocking and unpleasant.
Everton are one of the most famous names in English football and have been in the top division since the early 1950s, but there is now a real sense of turmoil around them.
Patrick Geary. He's interviewed music stars for much of the past 7 decades and, according to Guinness World Records, was the longest working disc jockey until he retired 2 years ago. That's the Hong Kong radio presenter Ray Cordero, who has died at the age of 98. Here's Uncle Ray, or the godfather of music as he was known, in action.
It's All the Way with Uncle Ray. Music of the 60s and 70s. Starting off as usual with the King, Elvis Presley.
There is this somehow invisible matching of the listener and myself, you know, like my family. I always did tell reporters that have come to interview me, there are two places that I would like to die. One is in my own bedroom, and the other one's in the studio.
Over the years, his interviewees included the Beatles, Frank Sinatra, and the Bee Gees, to name a few. Steve James is a DJ with RTHK and a colleague of the late Ray Cordero. What made him so special?
Everyone thinks of the same thing when they think of Uncle Ray. They think of the warm voice across all media, English and Chinese. He was the head of light music back at the beginning of the 60s. It was very much about the new music, the latest music that was sweeping the world, hence being flown over to meet the Beatles and just being connected with the music of the day and promoting it, and very much promoting all the new artists around Hong Kong. You know, he famously had a talent show that launched, of all people, Matt Monro, legendary singer Matt Monro, when he was an army boy in Hong Kong. And so always, you know, always promoting new artists, giving them a chance, whether it be a talent contest or later on the radio or the live shows where he would MC them, promote the bands. Famously, a young child star here in the 60s called Rowena Cortez actually referred to him as Uncle Ray. That's where he got his name. The nostalgia thing, I think, kicked in slowly along the way. The older music crept in, especially Hong Kong artists. People knew those names and great memories associated with it. Hong Kong culture is a very nostalgic sort of culture sometimes. You know, they like the good old tunes. He kept going on the air because he loved sharing the music. He loved the connection with the people.
Steve James on the legendary Hong Kong DJ and radio presenter Ray Cordero, who's died at the age of 98. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, here's a quick request from Oliver Conway.
We need some help putting together a special edition of the Global News podcast marking 3 years since the UK left the European Union. Has Brexit been a triumph or a disaster for global Britain, or something in between? We'd like to know what people around the world think of the UK now it's outside the EU. So please send in your thoughts, questions or comments to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And if you could include a voice note recording, then we'll try to get a response from our Brexit experts, Rob Watson, Katja Adler and Darshini David. Thank you.
And you can also use the same email address if you want to comment on this podcast. This edition was mixed by Lee Wilson. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time. Goodbye.
Save up to 65% during the Back to Business sale at HP.com through January 14th. Click the link or call 1-800-608-MYHP. Use promo code HPBusiness17 to save an extra 17% on business products. Exclusions apply.
Wow, is this deal for real?
Attention, woman browsing produce. Yes, those deals are real.
What is this place?
Grocery outlet, where you can get otherworldly deals on fresh produce every day.
I'm feeling such bliss.
It's the deals. They do that to people.
Grocery outlet, bargain market.
Welcome to Bargain Bliss.